أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وخاتم أنبيائه ورسله سيدنا وشفيعنا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي اما بعد فقد قال سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه المجيد وهو اصدق القائلين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا ايها الناس انا خلقناكم من ذكر وانثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا ان اكرمكم عند الله اتقاكم ان اللہ علیم خبیر صلوات Yesterday I gave you an example of a concocted hadith or a false hadith or fabricated hadith and you got the right answer. I want to share with you another hadith and use your faculty of reason. Use logic to see whether or not this hadith fulfills the litmus test of authenticity as far as you are concerned. It says, the chain of transmission, this is the sanad, Sheikh Sadduq dar Kamaluddin az Abi Umair wa u az Ibn Azine rivayat karde ke goft Hazrat Sadiq farmood, pederam farmood, jaddam amirul mu'minin salawatullahi alayhi farmood, پیش از ظهور منجی مردی قد بلند و سیاه در غرب به حکومت می رسد. After the chain of transmission it says that before the appearance of the one who will redeem us, meaning the Mahdi, there is going to be a person of very tall, قد بلند and black, who will appear from the west and he will be governing a state. Ke nishane ashkar az jaddam Abu Abdullah Bawas, and my grandfather has said that he is with him. Lashkar u kavitarin lashkar ruya zameen az, his army will be the strongest and the mightiest army around the world. Wa in lashkar sar zameen Karbala ra be tasarruf dar mi avard, and they will move and march towards Karbala. Ta zamine zuhur munjir amade sazad, they will go to Karbala in order to prepare the way for the arrival of the Mahdi. O khun muddayan durugin janashin jaddam amirul mu'minin ra dar najaf wa qum be zamin mirizad, he will shed the blood of those who are the false claimants to be the successors of Amirul Mu'mineen, or false claimants to be the Mahdi. Wa naiban durugun Mahdi ra ruswa misazat, and those who are falsely claiming to be the Mahdi, he will disgrace them and humiliate them. Dar an zaman shi'ayan ma na bayad shak kunad ke u ba mast. When this particular situation happens, our Shia should not have any element of doubt in their mind. Shak na konad, la yashuk. Don't ever doubt that he is one of us. Biharul Anwar, Jild Sizdahom, Babis Siyoyak. Babis Siyom. How many of you think the hadith is true in the men's side? No? Is hadith about Imam Sahib al-Zaman? Okay. In the ladies' side? Okay. Wow, you guys are too smart. Okay. I thought yesterday was a false hadith, so today you would say true hadith. But I guess it is a made-up hadith. This is hadith made up when Mr. Obama was elected. You know how? We say Obama's, Obama's. In Farsi, it means he is with us. U means he pronoun, ba is with preposition, ma is us, so Obama us, meaning he is with us. Sometimes when Mr. Obama would say something good before he was elected, they would say in newspapers, Obama's. When he would say something not in favor of Muslims, the next day article, Obama nist. He's not with us anymore. Okay, so this hadith is made up by somebody. But anyways, you figure this out. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. We are commemorating, I believe, tonight is the sixth night of the month of Muharram. We can categorize the Karbala episode as a meta-historical phenomena. A meta-historical phenomena is something that is not subscribed or that is not bound by time or space. It transcends space, time, and imagination. We call a meta-historical phenomena. It is not limited by space, not limited by the particular land. It is atemporal and aspatial. It is in this context that we have a hadith which says, "Kullu yawmin Ashura, kullu ardin Karbala." Every day is a day of Ashura, meaning a day to fight for justice and equity and peace and harmony. And every land is a land that is sacred. Any land in which you promote justice becomes sanctified like Karbala. The entirety of the earth is sacred. There's a hadith which says, the Prophet is reported to have said, the whole of the earth is my masjid, is a masjid, mosque. We think that a particular land somehow becomes sacred because we have recited a formula of recitation. It's a ritual, good ritual. And the thing becomes a masjid now. It doesn't mean that before you recite the formula, the place is not as sacred. It is equally sacred. It is equally worthy of respect and reverence. So, we are told by the hadith of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq al-Salam that every land in which we champion the cause of universal values becomes the land of Karbala. And every day in which we champion the cause of freedom and justice and peace and harmony, we work in tandem, in partnership, and we remove hate. We inspire and permeate love and remove this animosity and anger. It becomes a day of Ashura. We say it is a meta-historical event because it is an experiential phenomena. It is not something that we are only narrating as a past history. It rather has a direct relationship with us. We experience the phenomena of Karbala. That's why we say it's meta-history. If it was strictly a historical narrative, then Karbala finished, it came to an end in Muharram of 61 Hijri, 680 of the Common Era. And therefore, when I narrate the historical narrative of Karbala, it should not impact you. The history is over. A meta-historical phenomena is also something that a reader experiences and participates in the phenomena as he is reciting history. You see, when we recite the historical narrative of Karbala, we feel like the Karbala phenomena is very fresh. Is it true? We feel like Karbala happened in the very recent past. And this is an indication of the meta-history. We are experiencing the phenomena not in the distant past, but rather we can experience the phenomena also in the contemporary age. And we can relate the Karbala episode to present-day examples. Wherever we find injustice, we can relate this to Karbala. Wherever we find people who are oppressors, we can relate the model, the paradigm of meta-historical paradigm of Karbala, and say this is not the paradigm of Karbala. It's an interesting phenomenon that we have this narrative that is being played in front of us, the Karbala narrative, but we are not only spectators, but rather we are participants. A meta-historical phenomenon means that you are not just observing as a dispassionate audience member, But it means that you are integral part of the narration, that is, the drama is being unfolded with us as being actors. That's why we say Karbala is unique phenomena. Not only mentioned by us as Shia, mentioned by those other scholars who have talked about the vibrancy and the dynamism of this particular narrative that revives and gives a sense of dynamism to Shiism is unparalleled. After 13 centuries, it can bring about the same kind of emotion that it brought about in the land of Karbala more than 13 centuries ago. Our challenge is this. I think our attachment to Imam Hussein is not to be questioned. Our loyalty to Imam Hussein is not under scrutiny. Our challenge is to be able to translate his particular vision and worldview, which was a Quranic worldview. And therefore, when we say that we are attached to Imam Hussein and we have this bond of affection for him, it means that we have an equal bond of affection for the Quran. Because we believe, we have a hadith as well in which the Imam has taught us that the Imams and the Prophet are supposed to be the speaking Quran, the embodiment of the Quran, Al-Quranun Natiq. The speaking Quran, the walking Quran, the living Quran who exemplifies the Quranic values. But we also have another Quran referred to as Al-Quranus Samit. And that is equally important. The textual Quran, the silent Quran that cannot speak. And that's why we can manipulate it. That's why we can torture it. That's why we can distort it. We can misread. It is silent Quran. Yes, but these two go together. If you abandon one, people can manipulate the scripture and do damage to Imam Hussein's cause, like we see today, and we have seen. Imagine within a 50-year span, you have an army on one side, an army on the other side, both are offering prayers. Both are saying in the adhan, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. Both are testifying that Muhammad is the seal of the Prophet. Both know that Imam Hussein is the grandson of the Prophet. There were people in the other side of the army of Umar ibn Sa'ad who had seen the Prophet. At least they had heard the reports. And yet, they have this sense of confrontation, and with what barbarity, with what savagery, with what kind of callousness and inhumanity. Within 50 years, and they are reciting Quran as well. Don't think there were people who were just, you know, people who were purchased by Ubaidillah ibn Ziyad or Yazid. There were some of them, Wahuffaz, they were Hafiz al-Quran. They had memorized the Quran by heart. The point I want to make is this. They had the Quran in their heart, but it was a manipulated understanding of the Quran. They had disconnected themselves. Whenever we disconnect ourselves from the anchoring of the Quran in its ethos, in its ethics, in its morality, in its spirituality, then you can have this kind of a phenomena of fighting against the grandson of the Prophet, shedding his blood, and feeling that you are victorious. You know, one of the boasting claims they made after they had massacred and they had asked their horses to go and stomp over the bodies. Look at the barbarity. Barbarity. The Quran is memorized in the hearts. And they have no qualms asking the horses to go and stomp over the bodies of the deceased whose heads have been taken out. In those cultures, in that particular era, you normally take the heads as a sign of your victory. And to show that you have been able to defeat the enemy, and you present this to the emir or to the caliph. And they did this to get their prize, to get their congratulations. And they first took these heads of the shuhada. First they went to where? They went to Kufa, isn't it true? And then they went to Damascus to present this as a sign of victory, and the party of Imam Hussein were referred to as Bughat, in the literature. They said these were the rebels, the rioters, the dissidents. You dissent and you can be called a rebel. Look at some of the Muslim world. You disagree with the government policy. We have every right to scrutinize the governments. When Imam Ali sent Malik Ashtar to Egypt, an Imam is sending him. He says to Malik Ashtar, people will look at you with the same magnifying scope, with the same kind of scrutiny that you used to scrutinize those before you. They have every right to criticize you. They have every right to reprimand you. They have every right to ask you, be accountable. Yes? And he's Malik Ashtar. And Imam is saying, don't think that you are beyond any kind of test. No, you have no such kind of immunity. You are not masoom. Just like you used to bring about issues of concern, and you used to complain about the mode of behavior and conduct and policies and embezzlement and waste of money and oppression and so on about others, the people of Egypt have every right to put you under that same level of scrutiny and reproach you, reprimand you, criticize you if you go outside, out of bounds. Many a times the Imam would send governors, when he would receive complaints, he would summon them back. He would bring them back. You have no right to be there. Imam Ali is a pivot of moral, ethical values. He is a pivot. It's a pillar. And that's why we are so proud. I mean, the books that they write about Imam Ali, you will see, always they talk about justice. Asawtul Adalatul Insaniya, for example. The Voice of Human Justice by George George, a Christian. When he wrote the book, he said the quality of the Imam that is so prominent when I read Imam Ali's character and behavior is his side of justice. Social justice, economic justice, political justice, justice within his own family, justice that permeates each and every action that he performs. It's a very profound lesson. You know, that Imam Ali is teaching us that all of us are open to scrutiny and all of us need to make sure that we fulfill the obligation that we have vis-a-vis the people, people of every right. And people are equal, by the way, the Imam said to Malik Ashtar. Don't think Muslims have any superiority when you are there. You will treat them as equal citizens. We are equal citizens under the umbrella of God. The only difference is this. Either they are brothers who share the same religion as you, or they are members of humanity who share the same humanity with you. But you cannot degrade them, you can't denigrate them, you can't call them inferior citizens. Look at the minorities who are living in the Muslim world. You don't think they have disabilities and they suffer from inferiority? We need to watch out. This is not what Imam Ali was preaching. His model of governance is something very different, very different. And Imam Hussein is being called, and his group is being called Bughat. The same kind of vocabulary we hear nowadays. They were dissenters. They were rebels. They were rioters. Baghi. Look at the brutality of this. The culture, the Arab culture had resurfaced with the same kind of aggression, the same kind of ferocity. The Prophet tried so hard to transform that Arab culture of Jahiliyyah, the tribalism, and bring about this culture of Islam that was one of equity and justice. Again, the Arab culture has come with force. How do we say this? You know, we have some confusion about how many people were there, shuhada. Some people say there were 72. I'm sure there were not. There were many more than 72. Although we repeat 72 as a number that somehow is magical, it's not 72, we know for sure. We don't know how many more. The reason being this, is that normally when you belong to a tribe that is inferior, or you belong to a slave, a tribe from whom you were a slave, and we had some slaves who gave their lives to Imam Hussein, and we'll remember one tonight, he was a Turkish slave. We had slaves who were prepared to go in the fronts and sacrifice their lives. And the heads of these kinds of people was not regarded to be dignified to take. This is the barbarity of the culture. This is why we say spiritual malaise. This is jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah means you bury people alive, you do female infanticide. This is jahiliyyah. Not jahiliyyah in terms of intellect. Not jahiliyyah in the sense of not knowing the literature. Not jahiliyyah in the sense of not being in the business, mercantile business, where Mecca was certainly very active business-wise in terms of all the caravans they were passing by. And Mecca was the hub. Mecca was the nexus for all kind of economic activities. So yes, Mecca was economically vibrant. Mecca was certainly, in terms of literature, very vibrant. But in terms of these spiritual values, they were in a state of jahiliyyah. And that's the point we tried to make yesterday, is jahiliyyah does not mean to be illiterate. Jahiliyyah means to be spiritually illiterate, to be spiritually bankrupt. We say the community is in the state of jahiliyyah. A community that is consumeristic, that is wasteful, that is individualistic, that does not care about anybody but themselves. Well, we are approaching that particular definition of you can be living in post-modernity and we can maybe be referred to as jahiliyyah. Is it possible or not? It's quite possible. Sayyid Qutb, one of the Sunni scholars who was executed by the regime, he called this era in which he was living, that is the 1960s, 1970s, as the era of jahiliyyah. But we are very educated. We are not uncivilized. Jahiliyyah in the sense of you have all this high tech, we have all this intellect, we have all this economic progress and so on. But in terms of spiritually, there is something that is, there is a big void, a big emptiness. And that's why Sayyid Qutb said that we are living in jahiliyyah. Of course, I don't agree with many of his writings, by the way. I just like this particular terminology. I can't disagree with Sayyid Qutb. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Sayyid Qutb, may God bless his soul, was a man who felt the pain. He was a man of social justice. Yes, you can disagree with his writings. I think he went on the extremes because he was so angry. You know, he was so angry with how the Muslims were being mistreated in the Muslim world that his anger overtook him. And that's why he became so bitter. And his writings changed. If you read his writings progressively, his writings that he wrote in the early days, the writings that he wrote when he came to America, the writings that he wrote when he went back from United States to his hometown, it is a kind of a progression of that sense of anger, hostility. You can't blame him, maybe. He's a very nice commentary, Quranic commentary called Fi Zilal al-Quran, Under the Shade of the Quran. Yes, we can disagree with Sayyid Qutb, but he was also a man of great passion to remove the pain and the suffering of human being, to restore back the spiritual compass. And in that regard, he's worthy of all the respect and all the reverence. Salawat. The point being is this, that there are two kinds of Quran that are organically intertwined. You disconnect them, you are disconnecting the message, and you will bring about possibly and likely a manipulation of the scripture. And it happened. It happened in Karbala. We saw it very blatantly. It happened in all reigns. Even in the time of, imagine, Muawiyah is not very far from the Prophet's time. Their companions, I mean, imagine, you have Battle of Jamal. On one side you have Talha and Zubair and Aisha and others, companions. On the other side you have Imam Ali and his companions. Battle of Siffin. Doesn't it shock you sometimes? How is it possible to be so close to the Prophet's era when you have seen him? And yet, one can become so blinded. Battle of Siffin, we had huge armies. 90,000 may be on one side, 120,000 on the other side, and they are prepared to shed blood. And they did shed blood in large quantity, by the way, large numbers of loss of life. Very amazing. The Quran, we had many, many huffaz al-Quran, by the way. Be very sure. We had the Kharijis, who were the very extremists, the one who killed Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib by hatching a plot in Mecca. They hatched the plot to kill the Ma'asum Imam in Mecca. These people were not like you and I. They used to fast the whole day. They used to worship the whole night. Their bodies were lean. They were slim. Because they used to exercise. They were ascetics. You could see the sign of prostration on their forehead. And the callus would sometimes grow so much that they would have to cut it. These were not ordinary people. These were what you would call pious. Pious, but in a dangerous sense. That's why the Imam said, you know, what they say is true. La hukma illa lillah, they would say. They would say there is no command except God. And how come Imam Ali accepted to agree with Muawiyah under this arbitration? The Imam said, what they say is true. But the way they interpret what they are saying, that is wrong. That's the point I want to make. Is yes, the Quran is there textually. It is how you use it. And this is why the Quran, we say, can be approached in two ways. Al-Quranun Natiq, we remember Imam Hussein ibn Ali. Equally, we need to remember the silent Quran, the textual Quran, that is being abused and misused on an ongoing basis, and because it can't speak, people can get away with it. If only it could speak. And it will one day, inshallah wa ta'ala, on the Day of Judgment, the Quran will speak. I'm pretty sure. And will speak against those of us who have been manipulating the scripture. Salawat. So two approaches in reading the scripture, the Quran. We said that as we are trying to understand this phenomena of trying to develop our worldview, we want to see all the components, because the religion is a complex phenomena. Religion is not just rituals. Religion is not just institutions. Religion is not just emotional component. Religion is not just philosophy or theology or mysticism. Religion is a complex and integral part of our existence. And therefore, we want to know this, all these things in a particular context. We don't want to become just talk about rituals. We don't want to talk about the Quran as a ritual and forget. For example, talk about the Quran as a thawab. If you read the Quran, you get so much thawab. Well, yes, that's good. But that's one aspect of the Quran. We want to see the totality, the whole picture. And that's why we say the Quran can be approached in two ways. One is to try to understand the Quran from this multi-dimensional perspective, meaning from theological angle, from philosophical angle, from a legal perspective, from an irfanic perspective, from all these different perspectives that we have, spiritual perspective. And we have Quranic tafsirs that are like this. We have Quranic tafsirs that are spiritually oriented. We have Quranic tafsirs that are philological, meaning they are grammatically, they are oriented towards grammar, towards Arabic grammar. We have. That means the Quran is multidimensional. We know this. The Imams have told us that the Quran has different levels of depth. So one is to understand the Quran from this multidimensional perspective, and the other approach that we want to avoid is the Quran can become a tool for us to do for us what we would like it to do. The Quran can become a very powerful tool, a powerful instrument, if we want it to do what we would like to do. I have made my own preset assumptions. I made my conclusions where I want to go. And here, lo and behold, what better thing than Quran to convince everybody? So I pick up the Quran and selectively pick out verses that I like, because the Quran was revealed, of course, in a course of 23 years. You have to know the sequence, the chronology, you have to know the context. So if I selectively take things the way I like, and then put them all together and make a theory that supports me, this is called manipulation of the Quran. What we see being done in many parts of the Muslim world. For example, if you hear Bin Laden, he recites many Quranic verses, by the way. You can hear many of the Quranic phrases and nomenclature, but the way he plays with them is something quite different. But manipulation of the scripture, and we can do this. We can manipulate scripture for social formations, for forming social practices, and we can manipulate scripture, most importantly, for power games, for power relations, and to gain some kind of ascendancy in terms of power. This is where scripture is very important, by the way. Not just in Islam, in all religions. If you have a religious community, the best way when you want to talk about power and you want to arrogate to yourself, if I want to arrogate to myself all the power, well, the best tool for a religious community that has a religious ethos is certainly the Quran. In power games, we have used and misused the Quran. Salawat. Look at the Battle of Siffin. How the Quran is being used and misused. On the side of Imam, the speaking Quran is saying, who is interpreting the Quran, he's giving a commentary of the Quran. He's saying that don't listen to those guys. They raised the Quran on the spears, on the lances, and they asked for a truce just when they were on the verge of defeat, when they were almost being devastated by Imam Ali's army to the commandership of Malik Ashtar. Amr ibn al-As, he was a very shrewd guy. Lots of machinations we have in throughout history. His name comes in many of this demagoguery. In any event, he gives a very creative idea. He says the people on Imam Ali's side, they're very religious people. They're very pious people. But probably low in intellect, but very pious people. Right? He said the best way to create this sense of confusion in their minds is raise the Quran. That means Quran was being written, by the way. The whole debate about tahrif al-Quran, whether Quran has been changed or altered or distorted. Well, we had Quran in the Battle of Siffin. At least we had parchments. If we didn't have the whole of the Quran in Battle of Siffin, certainly we had a good part of the Quran already written down, whether on skins of animals, on parchments, whatever it may be. But certainly we have evidence that the Quran was written down. It is not strictly an oral transmission. The Western scholarship, like Professor Wandsworth had argued, his theory is now has been completely disproven. He argued that the Quran is a reflection of the social practices of the two centuries of the Muslim world. Meaning the Quran, when the Quran came into being, it is just a composition of the social values, the social norms, and they composed this to give a sense of credibility, and they gave it to the Holy Prophet. Well, long before that, we have Sunni and Shia. It proves that the Prophet used to ask his scribes to write down the Quran. One of the arguments of Professor Wandsworth was that in the Arab culture is oral transmission. The Arab culture was not into writing. But it is now not true, because we know that we have evidence of there were parchments of the Quran written down. There were scribes. He said, well, ask them to raise the Quran on the spears and you will create a sense of ambiguity in their minds. Exactly what happened. They raised the lances because they could read the minds of Imam Ali's followers. They knew that these guys may be very, very pious, but in terms of intellectual underpinning, they're quite weak. They can turn against Imam Ali in a moment. As they raise the Quran, of course, there's a commotion now in Imam Ali's side. Some people who are very, very holy and very, very pious and very, very muttaqi, they go to Imam Ali and they say, listen, they have raised the Quran. The Quran is supposed to be our judge. The Quran will be the arbiter, and therefore you must declare cessation of war, because they have said, and the Quran says in chapter 49, a verse in the Quran, when two Muslim armies fight, when one of them is prepared to accept and bring a stop, a closure to the war, the other side has to also accept. Imagine, these guys, because they know a couple of verses, they are dialoguing with the Imam and saying that, you know, bring it to an end. That's it. It's over. Imam Ali reasons with them and tells them, listen, this is a plot. It's a ploy. It's a gimmick. It's a game. They're trying to fool you. They're trying to trick you. Be careful. Just that now they're on the verge of defeat, this is only a stratagem. And therefore you should try to look beneath that. Be smart. Be sophisticated to see beneath the surface and don't get so emotional. We become so emotive. Oh, the Pope said so and so, go and torch houses, go and torch buildings, go and torch cars, break windows. The Pope said something against our Holy Prophet. Did they make a cartoon against us, the Danish cartoon? Oh, we are very emotional people. We are very angry. Yes, we will go and torch. We'll go and create damage. And to show the power of the Muslims, that if you make us angry, we Muslims, don't underestimate our power. Our savagery, we are 1.4 billion. Is that the message that we want to convey? That we are so emotional, that our intellect is paralyzed. A big mistake. We give such a negative image about Islam. On one side we say, Islam stands for peace. Okay, terrorism. Islam stands for peace. People are torching. Because they're so cartoons. You said you have done an act of sacrilege. You defamed our Holy Prophet. Yes, the cartoons were extremely, extremely distasteful, extremely, extremely abhorrent and revolting, extremely hurtful. And by the way, freedom of religion and freedom, when we say freedom of society, it is not boundless freedom, by the way. It was a grave error to allow for these kinds of cartoons to have been published. I mean, one can argue it crosses the boundary of freedom in a civil society. We also have preservation of sacred values as well. In any event, that's another story. What do we mean by freedom? When we talk about freedom in a civil society, that's another issue. In any event, yes, we had every right to be hurt. Yes, I like you, love my Prophet. I like you, love my Quran, like anybody else. Anybody who comes and claims this high holiness, be very careful of those kinds of people. The same people can turn against you. Don't make this display that I'm so pious. These academicians who learn in the West, we need to go to Hausa. Be very careful. Or vice versa. These guys in the Hausa, oh gosh, they're so backward. They still haven't learned modern methodologies. We in the West, we know about this phenomena of modern methodologies. That's also a problem. Anybody who makes those kinds of claims of holiness, that I'm too pious, I'm too muttaqi, be very careful of the same kind of people, because they are the first group that can turn against you and recoil and fire you. Telling Imam Ali, Imam Ali says, no, listen to me. The speaking Quran is giving a commentary. He's giving a proper exegesis. And he's saying, move on. The war continues. They come again. They're more angry now at Imam Ali. They say, didn't we tell you? Put a stop to this. Because they have raised the Quran. And once the Quran has been raised, we bring a truce. Let the Quran decide. Hukm of the Quran. Look at the audacity. They said to the Imam that if you don't recall and summon back Malik Ashtar, we will kill you. We will kill you. Isn't it surprising? Isn't it not jarring? It should be shocking, you know. The same people who can give up their lives for the sake of Islam, they have told Imam Ali, bring him back. We'll finish you up. The same Kharijis. You think Kharijis were not religiously, spiritually, they were very spiritual people. You know, like I said, they went to Mecca to hatch a plot, to give it the sense of blessing. And then the same people have no qualms in the mosque. While the Imam is offering prayers, they have no qualms in hitting him for the sake of assassinating him. It's a real, real complex phenomena. That religion can become evil. The point I want to make is, Religion can be a powerful force of positive change and reform. Religion, if it is misused, can become a very powerful force of evil. And that's the lesson that we see, that both these go together hand in hand. Salawat. So we want to understand our Quran, like I said, from this multiple perspective. And therefore, as we read the Quran, as you do commentary of the Quran, don't do so univision. Try to do it from a multi-dimensional perspective. Otherwise, you will get a very distorted image of what the Quran is saying. Look at what the Quran says about itself. It should also be read, by the way. The Quran is a divine speech. Imagine when we read the Quran, we are participating in that verbatim utterance of the divine. So it's something very important to read. That's why the Quran is called Qara. Qara means to read, to recite. It's a book of recitation as well. But it is also, it has all the other functions as well. It calls itself Al-Huda. It's a book of guidance. So you have to understand the Quran as well. It calls itself the book of Furqan. Furqan means something that can distinguish true from false. But how can the Quran be a distinguisher? How can the Quran be a demarcator when we don't know the content? If you rely on me to tell you what the Quran says, you are in deep trouble. Because I have my own biases. I have my own agenda. You have to read, exercise your intellect, and begin to understand the Quranic phenomena. The Quran came for all of us. The Quran says, it is also a book of dhikr. Dhikr means to remember, to remind ourselves. Whenever we are drifting away from our moral compass, our ethical compass, our spiritual barometer, the Quran reminds us, this is, come back in this territory, come back. It's a dhikr. And that's what the Sufis, when they say dhikr, they say they want to remember God to such an extent that they forget their own selves. They forget the ego, the I-ness. They want to remember God, and they want to dissolve in God to such an extent, to such a high degree of annihilation, that they annihilate and perish themselves, and now they cannot see themselves, known as al-fana. Many of the scholars, by the way, misunderstood, I think, these poor Sufis. They didn't mean polytheism, by the way. They were not mushrik. I mean, they were executed, you know. They never meant, I don't think they meant, you know, that they were somehow saying that I am God. It's allegorical, it's symbolic in the imagery of Sufism. It comes very frequently in Sufi literature. But those who were the jurists, those who were legal scholars, those who were theologians, they were shocked by the vocabulary of the Sufis. But there is an inner meaning. They said, no, these guys are mushrik, let's finish them off. The Sufis, when they say this, they want to annihilate in God because they want to remember nothing but God. They want to represent all the values that God represents, all the sifat that God has, all the asma'ul husna that God is, we exhibit. If God is kind, we want to be kind at the human level. If God is just, we want to be just at the human level. This is what they mean. I don't think they mean that now they have become part of Godhood. They have become part of divinity. I don't think so. It's a great misunderstanding and a great injustice to them to say, Ghazali, a Sunni scholar by the way, Ghazali was the chief of the jurists in Nizam al-Mulk in the 10th century, 10th, 11th century. And he was the chief in the department of Islamic legal theory and a great scholar by the way. Did you know we also have great Sunni scholars, by the way? Did you know that? We have some very great Sunni scholars. One of them is Al-Ghazali, who died in the year 1111. Now, I hope nobody says, you know, he's become Sunni. I don't know. Does it mean you can't appreciate virtue and beauty around the world of scholarship? Anyways, in his years where he was the chief of the department of the Islamic legal theory, he used to teach, he has written books on this topic, but he felt something, there was some emptiness in his heart, he felt. Law does not resolve his
his hesitancy. So then he does kalam, theology as well. Doesn't help him either. He decides to give his resignation from Nizam al-Mulk and go on a search. And he goes for a number of years, I think 10 plus years around the world, to try to understand how can he discover God with certainty, with yaqeen. Law, yes, it's good. But he didn't have that sense of what we call experiencing certainty of the existence of God. He didn't have that experiential phenomena. Yes, he had law, he had intellectual arguments, but he didn't have the phenomena of experiencing religion. He writes a book later on, Munqidh, something like this, Min al-Dalal. That, you know, something saved me from going astray. Min al-Dalin, we say, right? He writes his book, he explains his spiritual journey, that what was lacking in him was spirituality. And he is a Sunni scholar that he gave back the value perhaps to Sufism, to mysticism. He almost became a semi-mystic. It gave a sense of respect back to mysticism in Sunni Islam. In Shia Islam, we have always had respect for esoteric mystical sciences. I'm talking about in Sunni Islam, when the Ash'ari school rebounded with people like Ibn Hanbal and others, they removed all kind of spirituality from Sunni corpus of literature. Ghazali is the one who brings it back in the Sunni tradition with equal ferocity, with equal force. He writes, you should try to read that book. I think it's translated, it's called Deliverance from Error. I think, yeah, Deliverance, Munqid Min al-Dalal, Deliverance from Error. At least I've seen a translation somewhere. Look at his journey. And then he feels, yes, now I've discovered God. I've seen God. Experientially. Not just intellectually or dogmatically or ritually, but also experientially. But you know, Al-Ghazali, he did something else that was not so nice. He gave a death blow to Sunni philosophy. You know, he wrote a very nice book. Again, he is extremely good in arguing, but he can also be so clever in his arguments to defeat you. You know, he spent 3 years, he didn't know philosophy. He spent 3 years studying philosophy from Aristotle to Farabi, Plato, everybody, to master philosophy. 3 years. And he said that I found this 3 year time while I was still teaching in Nizam al-Mulk, I used to robe a few minutes here and there, a few hours here and there, and then I would read philosophy. Amazing. The guy is the chief of Nizam al-Mulk. He's teaching classes to the best of all students. And he says, I was able to find time to master philosophy in 3 years. Really remarkable. We spent how many years trying to write dissertation and we can't finish. It's so hard, isn't it? And we have so many excuses. When I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I would always find an excuse not to do it. Right? This gentleman, this scholar, may God bless his soul, understood philosophy and he mastered it. If you read his book, it's called Tahafudul Falasafa, The Refutation or the Incoherence of the Philosophers. An excellent work in which he is refuting the philosophical arguments about religion. And he does a wonderful job. And that was a death nail in Sunni philosophy, because after that, Sunni philosophy never recovered. We had some small periods in Spain of, you know, small life. But overall, Sunni philosophy from that day onwards, unfortunately, never recovered because the blow was so hard. Then so hard. He had mastered. You know, he's another Sunni Muslim scholar tried to refute Ghazali. And what do you think the name of his book was? The name of the book of Ghazali was Refutation of the Philosophers, Tahafutul Falasafa, or the Incoherence. Really, it means incoherence of the philosopher. What do you think this other scholar wrote about, Ibn Rushd, Averroes? What do you think was the title of his book? Just a guess. Those who know Arabic, anybody who knows Arabic? Yeah, we have somebody who knows Arabic. Where is Dr. Ali? I saw Dr. Ali. Where is Dr. Ali? Oh, yeah, hiding there. That means your wife is also here. So, what do you think was the title of the book? Somebody wants to argue against Ghazali and try to prove that no, philosophy has its own place. And it's in Spain. It's in Ibn Rushd, Averroes. We had fantastic scholars, by the way. You read them and you begin to marvel at the richness of Islamic intellectual sphere. Really is remarkable. Did you know that when we read philosophy, we still read Ghazali? After how many centuries? We still read Ibn Rushd. After how many centuries? Amazing. There's a student who is doing a PhD dissertation at our university, and she's working on Ghazali and a Christian scholar. In contemporary, you know. So don't think Ghazali is over and, you know, Ghazali was in the ancient time. What do you think is the title of his refutation? Okay. I'm not going to bother you anymore. I think you know the answer. When I tell you, you'll say, oh, if he called it tahafutu tahafut, the incoherence of the incoherence of the philosophers. That means I'm refuting the refutation of Ghazali. And it's very kind of, you know, it sounds pretty nice. Tahafutu tahafut, refuting the refutation of you. He writes a very nice book, and I think his arguments are pretty strong as well, but he could not recover. Ghazali gave a blow, I believe, in Sunni Islam that they never could recover. And this is why you see, even today, for example, and I'm concluding, if you look around the Sunni world and you look at the syllabus, the curriculum in the Sunni seminaries, you won't find much component of philosophy, very small, if any. Nowadays they've begun, I'm told, in Azhar. You won't find the major components in Irfan, for example, you know, because it came to a standstill. We don't have today, for example, can we name Sunni philosophers who are working on philosophical issues today, metaphysical issues today? In Shia Islam, there are plenty. You ask who is working on philosophy in the Shia tradition? Many. Allama Tabatabai, we know him as a Mufassir. He was also a great philosopher. And you can see his philosophy, his philosophical bias in the Quran. When he's doing commentary, you can see Allama Tabatabai as a philosopher as well. It's one of the best commentary of the Quran. If you had to use a commentary for your classes, you know, and I use it, by the way, I use Allama Tabatabai for my classes. You had to have classes for tafsir, I think. Perhaps the best one that we have at our disposal is the one of Allama Tabatabai, because it is multi-pronged. He talks sociology, he talks philosophy, he talks hadith, he talks legal perspectives, he talks about philology, grammar. You will see that he will dissect the words in the Quran. He's beautifully done. The etymology of the Arabic word is this. The lexical meaning is this. Beautiful. You know, because it is a multi-pronged approach, it is a wonderful tafsir. Don't read tafsir that are unidimensional. It does injustice to the rich Quran. The Quran is very rich. He gives you mystical perspective sometimes. You see the spiritual aspect, you know. And that's the beauty of Allama Tabatabai. Unfortunately, the project didn't, I don't think they finished. They began translation, I know, at one time, this marhum Allama Sayyid Akhtar Rizvi. I think they never finished, right? Maybe up to volume 7 or 9 or something. Is he doing it now? That's very good. You know, I'd heard that, you know, anyways, this foundation I heard was trying to do, at least they were hoping to do it, this Alawi Foundation. And now, but then, you know, now they're under scrutiny. You know, the Alawi Foundation in New York, it used to be called Pahlavi Foundation. Is this being recorded with the CIA? Anyways, it's in public knowledge. Anyways, the, you know, this phenomena of post 9/11, they have become so antsy, you know. Any kind of suspicion that they have, even if it is a speck, they come after you. Be very careful. We should be transparent. We should not have anything that is not accountable. Why? And we should have clean records anyways. But in this day and age, be extra careful. This Alawi Foundation, the Shah had multi-billion dollars that were frozen and then they were released with the condition that the money be spent within the United States and the money should be handled by people who are not affiliated with the government. So they should not channel the money to government, just to independent projects. And they used to, for example, help out various foundations, schools. They have helped, for example, McGill. They have given two chairs to Alawi Foundation to be able to give lectures in Persian language and literature. Two professors were hired because of the money. Half the money came from the Alawi Foundation in Colgate University, in Harvard, and so on and so. Many universities in Hartford Seminary, they gave money. They give half the money. And they were going to give half the money to our university, and boom, this happened. Tell about bad luck, you know. Anyways, no, we were not yet ready because we had hesitation. We have been thinking about this issue for almost ever since I went there. We were thinking what to do, but anyways, our university is quite conservative in these issues. It takes a lot of precautions. In any event, they do very good work. They give money to Islamic centers in Sacramento. I know, and it's public records. You can go and check it out. It tells you how much money they give. I don't know what happened. The government apparently failed. Whether they have proof, I don't know. But apparently they said that we can trace some of the money that was being used and spent for the cause of Iran. And the money was being given to Banki Milli. The money was being funneled towards this nuclear project. This is what the government lawyers are saying. And because of that, they have frozen, I don't know if they have frozen their assets, but certainly they are under litigation. And therefore, I'm sure that the money that they have, I don't think they can spend now just the way they like. And some of the mosques, you know, they want to liquidate if they get a judgment. If they get a judgment, they can liquidate the mosques. And there's also a very big high-rise building. I don't know how many floors, 20 or 30 floors in New York. And if they win, they will also sell this. How come I mentioned Alawi Foundation? What happened? Who is listening to me? Sorry? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. You see, only sisters can do this. Always, without a shadow of doubt. It's proven empirically. I can't say yakin, but the dhan is there, high probability. In any event, be very transparent and we should be careful in what we do. But I don't know why I even talk about transparency now. What was before that? Sorry? Oh yeah, Tafsir al-Mizan, transparency, and then Alawi Foundation. I don't know what is happening. But anyways, they are somehow linked. You have to do Tafsir and Ta'wil. Anyways, let's open the... I'm not moving at the speed I would like to move, but anyways, I think we are making good progress as well.
Thank you. We'll now have question and answers. We'll begin on the ladies' side, if there are any questions on the ladies' side.
The sister side, no.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
I just wanted to get some idea from you. What are the right books to read to get a sense of how Quran was compiled historically? There are many versions out, and just one wants to get some comfort around the process that was followed and how we came to what we have now.
Very important. You know, we should know exactly how the Quran was compiled and how we can prove the Quran is authentic. How can we prove the Quran has not been altered? You know, it's how many centuries has passed? All scriptures normally have some kind of what we call tahrif or interpolation or distortion. In English, we have limited choices, unfortunately. You know, if you talk about Persian or Arabic, we have plenty of literature that has been done, thorough study on this particular issue. that can give you a kind of certainty that yes, the Quran could not have been possibly altered. But in English, I think perhaps the best one would be the one by Marhum Ayatullah Khoi, may God bless his soul, Al-Bayan fi Tafsir al-Quran, which was translated by Professor Abdul Aziz Sachedina, and is called the Prolegomena to the Quran. An excellent translation that he has done with a good annotation, a good explanation of the issues that the Ayatullah Khoi brings up. And this is exactly how a work should be. So it's a very important work and is published, I think, by Oxford Press. It's very expensive, by the way. Unless if you're a professor, you can ask for an examination copy. But otherwise, or ask for book review, you'll review his book. It is expensive, but very worthy of reading and having on your bookshelves. There's another work from the Sunni perspective by a scholar whose name I forget, but he has done a very good work. And what is his name? It's called something like The Scripture. You know, and his name will come to me. He is something like Azim or Azma. This Azim is there somewhere in the name. But anyways, I can give you... He's done a very good job as well. And he gives you even, you know, manuscripts. He shows you pages from different manuscripts, just, of course, excerpts, to show you that, you know, because we had different kind of codices, masahif, you know. We had Mus'haf of, for example, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. We had Mus'haf of so-and-so. Mus'haf, we had different codices they were collecting. And then he shows you the different masahif, different codices, that the change, if any alteration. Because remember, the Arabic orthography was defective in those days. They didn't have what we have today, the dots and the vowels. And it was a mnemonic script. It was defective script. So therefore, of course, because they knew, they were Arabs. But of course, we could never read this without making an error. And that's why they made compilation of one. Anyways, he shows you this, that the amount of even variance, there are some variances, by the way, but the amount of variance is so minute. It is very minute in terms of voweling, let's say, just the vowels or the long ending. But it's so minute that it shows you really that the Quran, because the God has promised as well, right? نَحْنُ نَزَّلْنَا الذِّكْرِ Yeah, and we are the one, لَحَافِظُونَ We will preserve it. And I mentioned this in one program, and one of the young brothers like Muhammad, Muhammad Walji, right? Said, okay, but the person who was composing the Quran, he could have put this ayah too inside. It's a circular argument. The argument that you want to prove has to be independent of what you're trying to prove. Isn't it true? Yeah. Okay. Any more?
Okay, I think we'll continue.
All right, thank you. We are now moving on with the sacred narrative of Karbala. Like I said, the narrative is equally important, but it's a meta-historical narrative. It is not merely a narrative that I'm just regurgitating as something that is history. I mentioned to you yesterday that Imam Hussein led the prayers for both the armies, for his own companions and followers, and also for the army of Hur Ibn Yazid al-Riyahi. And they were both comfortable praying. And the Imam begins what we call this intellectual dialogue. Just like the Quran is dialogical, the Quran is a dialogue. The Imam begins his dialogue with the people and tries to reason with them. He says, أيها الناس إنها معذرة إلى الله عز وجل وإليكم. He says, I have an argument against you. إني لم آتكم حتى أتتني كتبكم وقدمت علي رسلكم أن أقدم علينا. I came to you after you wrote me many, many letters. And you sent many, many ambassadors who came to me, and they said, ليس لنا إمام. we don't have an imam. لَعَلَّ اللَّهُ يَجْمَعُنَا بِكَ عَلَى الْحُدَى. We are looking for an imam who can gather us together and join us towards guidance, al-huda, not for power. This is a quwwa, or siyasa, politics, or a dawla, state. Very interesting. Nothing about government, nothing about qudra and quwwa, power. يَجْمَعُنَا بِكَ عَلَى الْحُدَى وَالْحَقِّ. فَإِن كُنْتُمْ عَلَى ذَلِكَ فَكَدْ جِئْتُكُمْ فَإِن تُؤْتُونِ مَا أَتْمَعِنُّ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ أُهُودِكُمْ وَمَوَاثِيكُمْ أَقْدِمْ مِسْرَكُمْ. He says, if you are going to fulfill this promise and the covenant that you had made, the contract with me, and you are still prepared to stand by it, then I will visit your city. That means Kufa. وَإِن لَمْ تَفْعَلُوا وَكُنْتُمْ لِمَقْدَمِي كَارِهِينَ إِن صَرَفْتُ عَنْكُمْ إِلَى الْمَكَانِ الَّذِي أَقْبَلْتُ مِنْهُ إِلَيْكُمْ. And if you have had a change of heart, if you had a change of mind, and now you feel regretful that we gave all these promises to the Imam, but now we are not agreeable to his coming, the Imam says, so be it. The Imams don't impose. The Imams give you freedom, full freedom. If a religious scholar is not welcome, he leaves. We don't have to impose ourselves. You know? If communities invite us, we go. If they don't invite us, okay, that's fine too. If you have changed your mind, in saraftu ankum ilal makan alladhi aqbaltu minhu ilaykum, I will go to another place, or I will return back to the same place from where I had come. The Imam is not forcing. You know, the Imam is not forcing, but reasoning with them that you are the ones who invited, and you are the ones who sent messengers, and now you are the ones who have turned against the Imam who was supposed to guide you and guide them towards al-huda wal-haq. Also interesting is, he's not angry. The Imam could have begun, you know, remonstrating, or, you know, at least criticize them, reproach them. What kind of people are you? You are treasonous, you are betrayers, you are treasonous people. No. No anger, just irrational dialogue and discourse. Salawat. Before I start the Masaib, I want to share with you something that as we read the narrative of Karbala, to preserve the sanctity and the integrity of the Karbala narrative, we also must be very careful not to change it. You see, if you begin to tamper with the historical narrative, you do great injustice, no matter what your intentions are. Imam Hussein needs no help, believe me. One of the things that kind of brings an element of doubt is the story about John. John was certainly there in Karbala, we know for sure. John, who was a slave, slave of Abu Dharr, I believe. We certainly know that he was there. We certainly know that he was very loyal to Imam Hussein. We certainly know that he gave up his life. But as far as this conversation, we are not sure. It goes like this. John comes and asks Imam Hussein that, please give me permission to go and lay down my life for this mission of yours. And the Imam says, you came to us, that means you came from Abu Dharr, to find security and safety. And now you want to bring about more trouble for yourselves. Lil afia, I free you. You are now free to go. John doesn't agree. فَوَقَعَ عَلَىٰ قَدَمَيْهِ يُقَبِّلُهُمَا. He gets down and kisses the feet of Imam Hussein, وَيَقُولُ, and he asks the Imam, أَنَا فِي الرَّخَاءِ أَلْحَسَى قِسَاءَكُمْ وَفِي الشِّدَّةِ أَخْذُلُكُمْ. He says that in the time of safety and prosperity, I was the one who clung to you and you gave me full support. And now that you have times of difficulty, am I going to just abandon you? He says further, إِنَّ رِيحِ لَمُنْتِنُ وَحَسَبِي لَلَئِيمٌ. ولوني لأسود فتنفس علي بالجنة. He says, no, I want this odor of mine which is so unpleasant, the smell that is so unpleasant. وحسبي للئيم, my lineage, my genealogy that is so humble. ولوني لأسود, and my color that is black. فتنفس علي بالجنة. I want to do this, and inshallah, with your blessings, I would like to enter paradise so that ليطيب ريحي, so that the odor that I will then exude will be full of aroma and fragrance. ويشرف حسبي, and my genealogy will become dignified. ويبيض لوني, and my color of my complexion will become fair or white. لا والله لا أفارقكم حتى يختلط هذا الدم الأسود مع دمائكم. By God, I will not separate from you until and unless I have commingled or I have mixed my blood from a black person to your blood of Imam Hussein and his progeny. Now, there's an element of racism here. But we recite this, it's in our books. I'm saying that I, as a scholar, have elements of doubt. You can have your own opinion. Everybody has a right. And I also have a right to have my opinion. I'm just telling you my opinion. Doesn't mean that you should condemn me, by the way. Nor should I condemn you. It's an opinion. Right. So I don't want fatwas tomorrow, you know. Mayfil Ali, close it down, closure. I don't know. I'm just joking, of course. When John was a very loyal. We know in the Maqta literature, he was very brave. All of them, by the way, were very brave. He was one of the bravest ones. When he falls down, he gives a call to Imam Hussein, and Imam Hussein goes to rescue him, says the Maqta literature, and the Imam prays for him. Allahumma bayyid wajhahu wa tiba rihahu. O God, make his complexion fair. Make the odor that comes out nice smelling. وَحْشُرْهُ مَا الْأَبْرَارِ, and resurrect him with those who are the righteous. وَأَرِّفْ بَيْنَهُمْ وَبَيْنْ مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدْ, and resurrect him amongst those who will be with the family of the Prophet and the Prophet and who know the value of these individuals. Again, what I want to say is that be very careful as well as we read the history. We don't want to in any way change the history of our Imam, because then it loses its value and it becomes no more meta-historical narrative. I want to remember a slave, a Turkish slave. Don't underestimate the slaves. They loved the Imam perhaps more passionately than those who were freed. They loved to be with the Imams even after they were freed. This is the mark of character. This is the mark of love. You know, there was something Imam Hussein was doing that was a magnet. He was a pulling force even for those who didn't like him, let alone for those who were in his company and loved him. He was a Turkish slave of very low nobility in terms of tribe. And he was also a Quranic memorizer. And he asked the Imam that I want permission to go and fight in your cause. Of course, the Imam discouraged all of them that they were free to leave him and let him be by himself, because the enemy was just after his blood. They were not after the blood of his family or companions. And he gave them all the opportunities, all the free choice. Islam is about freedom till the very last night. There is no compulsion in faith. There is no apostasy. There is no law of apostasy or murtad. He tells him as well, to this very, his loving Turkish slave, that you should find yourself and rescue yourself. He says, no. And he fights. And what is so interesting is he recites some war poetry. And it's so beautiful in Arabic, but I know if I translate, it's going to lose some of that beauty. But anyways, he says in the Rajas when you are fighting, it was customary to recite poetry. He says, Al-Bahru min ta'ni wa darbi yastali. He says, the heart, the heat, the fire that is generated by my strikes and blows is so ferocious that it makes the ocean in flames. Meaning he's that kind of a soldier of Imam Hussein. وَالْجَوُّ مِنْ سَحْمِي وَنَبْلِي يَمْطَلِي. And the space that has been crowded due to my strikes are so plentiful that there is no more space in the ocean. إِذَا حُسَامِي فِي يَمِينِي يَنْجَلِي. When my shining sword shimmers in my right hand, يَنْشَقُّ قَلْبِ الْحَاسِدِ الْمُبَخَّلِ. It brings about tears. It tears apart those whose hearts are full of envy, enmity, anger, and greed. When they see me, he says, this Turkish slave working for the cause of Imam Hussein, this is his rajas. Like all the other martyrs, he gives out a call when he falls down on the battlefield. And it was normal. They were highly outnumbered, and the ultimate destiny for each of the shaheed was known ahead of time. It was just a matter of time. The imam is waiting for the call of help, istighatha. The imam knew exactly. The call comes and I have to go and again look at their bodies, pray for them, recover their bodies, and put them in the tent one after another. And Imam Hussein is not young, by the way. Some of the reporters said that we were so shocked to find this person. He had such kind of energy that he would just enter the heart of the army whenever there was a call of help given by anybody, istighath. The imam would just rush, remove the crowd of soldiers to go and pray or to say the last words to the martyr and recover him and bring his body. He had spiritual energy. When the call of this Turkish slave, istighatha bil Hussein, when it came, فَأَتَاهُ أَبُو عَبْدِ اللَّهِ وَأَتَقَنَهُ. When Imam Hussein heard him, he rushed and he put his arms around his neck and he embraced him. He's a slave, but he's loved by the Imam. فَقَال مَنْ مِثْلِ وَابْنُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ وَادِعٌ خَدَّهُ عَلَى خَدِّ. The Turkish slave is still in his last moments of breath and he says to Imam Hussein, who can compete with me in the honor and dignity when the son of the messenger of God has put his cheek against my cheek? And after he said this, after a few moments, the report says, ثُمَّ فَاضَتْ نَفْسُهُ الطَّاهِرَةُ. And his soul departs from his body and enters into the vicinity amongst the martyrs. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْكَلِبٍ يَنْكَلِبُونَ.